Just some ground rules, I guess, or information about the course. Some students sometimes want to get a grade in these Mises Academy courses. So if you would like to take the class for a grade, I'll make up two quizzes, one after week two and the other one after week five. And these are usually multiple choice or true and false tests or quizzes. And of course, if you just don't want to do that, you don't have to. It's optional, of course. But some students like to have a grade, and everyone who participates and takes the course will get an online certificate from the Mises Institute, a certificate of completion. And so that's about the only announcement I have for now. And feel free to email me at tdlow@aol.com. I'll write it down in a second. If you, in addition to sending me messages on the message board for the course, and I'm always glad to talk to students about anything related to the course. And so the purpose of the course is I thought that since I've done a lot of research over the years and written several books on this topic, I thought I would try to put it into a Mises Academy course that lasted 5 weeks. The usual routine for those of you who haven't taken one of these courses before is, at least with my classes, I think I usually give a 45 or 50 minute lecture, sometimes a little longer if it's the material warrants it. And then we spend a half hour to 45 minutes with Q&A, and so you can all ask questions on the chat or on the Q&A thing on your screen, and I'll do my best to answer them until the time runs out. And so that's the usual format, about a 45 or 50 minute lecture, class lecture, and then Q&A, and ask anything related to the course that you can think of. As I said, I'll do my best to answer them. And I think I thought this would be an important course to present through the Mises Institute at this time, because we really have the American economy, like a lot of the economies in other parts of the world, really has evolved into what Bob Hicks calls participatory fascism. Yes, we have democracy, we have voting, so it's not strictly speaking fascism along the lines of Nazi Germany or Mussolini's Italy, and it doesn't have the anti-Semitism and the crazy racial theories and things like that. But economic fascism, it was basically a system whereby private property was allowed, but it was very heavily controlled and regulated and regimented and subsidized in certain ways by the state. And so, and that's, in my view, that's really the system that has evolved in the United States, the economic system that has evolved. And it really is a variant of what used to be called mercantilism. And as I said, since I've written several books on the evolution of this, of how this came about historically, I thought it would be an interesting course. And it's also a good way to learn some Austrian economics, or the main concepts of Austrian economics, as illustrated by economic history. And those of you who have read some of my books know that that's what I do. It's basically applications of Austrian economics and Austrian political economy, as I call it, to the study of economic history. That's been my focus, my research focus, for quite a few years now. And so I'm going to start with, in the course title, I put the names Hamilton, Clay, and Lincoln in the Curse of Economic Nationalism. And that's because, historically, these three men, Alexander Hamilton, Henry Clay, and Abraham Lincoln, I think are more responsible than anyone else in creating this this system of corporate welfare that we have in America today. I called it in my article on Mises.org, government of the plutocrats, by the plutocrats, and for the plutocrats. And certainly the bailouts after the Great Recession started are a great illustration of what I'm talking about. Government of the plutocrats, for the plutocrats, by the plutocrats. And so that's what we're going to be doing. I'm going to try to hit some of the theoretical and historical highlights of how this whole system evolved, by telling a few historical stories and also integrating some Austrian economics into it. And I guess the first thing I'll do is give you a definition of the type of economic system that prevailed in much of the world, certainly Europe, at the time of the American founding. And so what I hope to do is to go talk about this subject historically, beginning around the founding era and zipping through history up to the present day, but looking at this theme of economic nationalism, which is really just another word for mercantilism. And so mercantilism was the reigning system of most of Europe in the 16th, 17th centuries and into the 18th century. And it was mercantilism that was the subject of the famous book by Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations. And so when Smith wrote this giant book, The Wealth of Nations, it was an attack or a critique on the system of mercantilism. And so let me give you Adam Smith's definition of mercantilism from The Wealth of Nations. The formal title of the book is An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations, but everyone just seems to call it The Wealth of Nations. Here's Adam Smith. He says, in the mercantilist system, the interest of the consumer is almost constantly sacrificed to that of the producer. And the restraints upon the importation of all foreign commodities which can come into competition with those of our own growth or manufacturer, the home consumer is evidently sacrificed to that of the producer. It is altogether for the benefit of the latter that the former is obligated to pay the enhancement of price which this monopoly almost always occasions. And end of quote. And Adam Smith was referring to protectionism or protectionist tariffs as a policy that plundered the consumer for the benefit of the producer. And so mercantilism involved a series of policies that essentially did that, that essentially benefited politically connected producers or businesses at the expense of consumers. And this, in Europe at this time, 16th, 17th, 18th century, this included government grants of franchise monopolies, protectionist tariffs, and that sort of thing, and also grants of subsidies to politically connected corporations for one reason or another, and also bailouts. And this was really the rotten economic system that the American revolutionaries fought a war against. They revolted and seceded from the British mercantilist system. One of the things that sparked the American Revolution was a series of taxes that were put on by the King of Great Britain on tea, on sugar, on the Stamp Act. It placed special taxes on every type of document, marriage licenses, and everything else. And the colonists were fed up with it. They thought that they were just being used as tax fodder for this mercantilist empire that benefited only the king and his supporters, the King of England and his supporters. And so it's not a stretch to say that the American Revolution was a revolution against British mercantilism. But as soon as the revolution was over, and even before the revolution was over, there was a group of men in American politics who understood that the mercantilist system lasted a very long time in Europe because someone benefited from it. And that's true of any type of economic system. If it lasts for a long time, it's because someone benefits from it, and that someone, or that group of someones, will be involved in politics in a very big way to try to make sure the system maintains itself and expands as long as possible. And so there was a group of men in America. And one of the leaders of these men, the intellectual leader by far, was Alexander Hamilton, who wanted to bring the British mercantilist system to America. Even though they had fought a revolution against it, they understood that if you're on the paying end of a mercantilist system, it's a bad thing. But if you're in charge of it, and you're on the tax collecting end, and you're in a position to spend the money that is raised through all these taxes, well then, power, glory, money, wealth, riches can be yours. And so these people became the nationalists in American politics, and their party was the Federalist Party, and they were known as the Nationalists as well as Federalists. And one of the articles I put on the syllabus is an article of mine that was in the Quarterly Journal of Boston Economics, because I think it is a very good illustration of this phenomenon of the early nationalists in the American political tradition wanting to get their way, to adopt mercantilism, and the key to it was always a central bank, a startup central bank. And so I'll quote Murray Rothbard in explaining what these men were up to. And Alexander Hamilton was the intellectual leader, and he was the political leader because he was the Secretary of Treasury under George Washington. He was the first Secretary of the Treasury. And here's what Rothbard said about this in his book, The Mystery of Banking. Said what these people, which included Robert Morris, who was possibly the wealthiest man in America and a defense contractor at the time, he was the real string puller behind Alexander Hamilton. Rothbard says that what they wanted was, quote, to reimpose in the new United States a system of mercantilism and big government similar to that in Great Britain, against which the colonists had rebelled. The object was to have a strong central government, particularly a strong president or king as chief executive, built up by high taxes and heavy public debt. The strong government was to impose high tariffs to subsidize domestic manufacturers, develop a big navy to open up and subsidize foreign markets for American exports, and launch a massive system of internal public works, that is, roads and canals built with government money. In short, the United States was to have a British system without Great Britain. And I think Murray Rothbard hit the nail squarely on the head with that paragraph. And then Rothbard goes on in his book, The Mystery of Banking, to say an important part of what he calls the Morris scheme was, quote, to organize and head a central bank. So the first central bank was called the Bank of North America, but it inflated its currency so much that within 1 year, no one trusted it, and the currency became essentially worthless, and the bank was privatized. But these people, of course, never gave up. It took them a long, long time. We didn't get the Fed until 1913, but we did have other central banks. We did have the First Bank of the United States and the Second Bank of the United States, which I'll talk about in a minute. And so Robert Morris, the financier, he was a Philadelphia businessman and banker and well-connected politically. He's called in some of the history books as the financier of the American Revolution. But as Murray Rothbard pointed out in one of his writings, Robert Morris profited from the American Revolution. He was a defense contractor. He didn't only lend money to the government. He made a lot of money, including making money on those loans to the government. And he adopted his young protege, Alexander Hamilton, who happened to be George Washington's aide-de-camp in the Revolutionary Army at a very young age, in his early 20s. And Hamilton knew next to nothing about economics and finance, but he was a very highly intelligent man. And so here's what Hamilton's biographer, Ron Chernow, who won the Pulitzer Prize for his biography of Alexander Hamilton, said about Hamilton, about how he became to be in touch with Robert Morris and got the job as Treasury Secretary, essentially. I'm just taking a quick look at what's going on the chat here. Okay, well, let me know if there's any problems with the audio. Hamilton, here's what Ron Chernow says about Hamilton. He said, Hamilton brushed up on money matters. This is before the revolution was over. He was still in the army. And had Colonel Timothy Pickering send him some primers, David Hume's Political Discourses, tracts written in English by the English clergyman and polemicist Richard Price, and his all-purpose crib, Postlethwaite's Universal Dictionary of Trade and Commerce, a dictionary. Hamilton sent a marathon letter to Morris that set forth a full-fledged system for shoring up American credit and creating a national bank. Those are the words of Ron Chernow, the historian. He's not an economist, certainly not an Austrian economist. And so what was in this letter? Well, basically in this letter, Alexander Hamilton said to Robert Morris, I agree with all of your policy proposals. I'm George Washington's assistant. The war is almost over. I'm looking for a job, and I think I agree with everything you want to do. We need corporate welfare. We need internal improvement subsidies by using tax dollars to build government-financed roads and canals. We need a central bank modeled after the Bank of England, and we need high protective tariffs. That's what he's saying, because that's what Robert Morris wanted. Robert Morris wanted especially a central bank to provide cheap credit to himself and his business partners and his business associates. So in this letter, this April 30th, 1781 letter to Robert Morris, Hamilton advocated protectionist tariffs, a central bank, taxes on land, that is property taxes, poll taxes, and a large public debt. And so Hamilton, from the very beginning, was known as an advocate of a large public debt for the sake of having a large public debt. It wasn't necessarily to establish the good credit of the United States or to finance any big public works project. He was quite Machiavellian in the reason he gave for public debt. And the reason he gave, and here's his own words. His words are, a national debt, if not excessive, will be to us a national blessing. It will be a powerful cement of our union. What is he talking about? Well, what he explained was that it would mostly be the more affluent or wealthier people of the country who would own government bonds. And they, therefore, would become a powerful lobbying force for higher taxes and bigger government to make sure there was enough tax revenue in the treasury to pay off the principal and interest on their bonds. And so that's the reason he gave for having a large public debt. It was not necessarily to establish good credit. Governments can establish a high credit rating simply by plundering the population with taxes. That's not good for the economy, it's not good for the taxpayers, it's not good for the society, but it's good for the government's credit rating. We have a AAA credit rating, but they're destroying their own economy in the long run by doing so. But that's the thing that he was advocating here. Okay, and so there was a famous, let me mention one more quote from Hamilton before I proceed. Hamilton was, this is what he once said, made the case for a central bank, he said, by saying this, Great Britain is indebted for the immense efforts she has been able to make in so many illustrious and successful wars because of the Bank of England. And so if America was to engage in illustrious and successful wars, it needed a bank, a national bank, to finance these wars. He said that he used the words imperial glory, which he thought would be a good thing to achieve. And he said, the tendency of a national bank is to increase public and private credit. The former gives power to the state for the protection of its rights and interests, end quote. So the purpose of having a national bank, according to Hamilton, was to grow the state, to grow the state and protect its rights, as though the state itself has rights somehow, and not individuals having rights. And there was a famous debate that took place between Hamilton and Jefferson over the constitutionality of a central bank. Hamilton wrote a report on this. If you look up Hamilton's reports on the web, you'll find his report on the constitutionality of a national bank. And you can also find Thomas Jefferson's response to Hamilton. This is where Hamilton knew that there was no constitutional authority for a national bank run by politicians out of Washington, even if it was partly or even mostly privately funded, but it was controlled by politicians in Washington, the nation's capital. He knew it wasn't constitutional because the Constitutional Convention had discussed the issue and had rejected the idea of a national bank. And it is not listed in Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution, which lists the constitutional functions of the legislature. And so this is where Hamilton invented the idea of implied powers of the Constitution. He said, yes, there's nothing in the Constitution that gives you the right to create such a bank, but you have to read between the lines. And in between the lines, there are implied powers. And of course, once you go down the road of implied powers, and you're going down the road of unlimited government, and the Constitution is made a mockery, because the politicians can just dream up any implied powers, they will dream up unlimited powers, and that, of course, is exactly what they have done over the generations. And in his debate with Jefferson, he relied on the Necessary and Proper Clause of the U.S. Constitution. This is a clause in the document where it says that the government can legitimately do certain things. I think there are 18 things listed there in Article 1, Section 8. And it has to do whatever is necessary and proper to achieve those things. And so Hamilton made the case that it is necessary to have a government-run bank in order to have a place to deposit tax revenues. Jefferson came back and said, it's not necessary, it's just convenient, because we have banks, we have private banks. The government could put tax revenues in any number of private banks. We don't need to have a bank run by politicians. And so they went back and forth before George Washington in two separate reports, and George Washington eventually signed off on the legislation to adopt a national bank. So this was always part of the agenda, to have a national bank. The agenda of the nationalists, of the mercantilists, the neo-mercantilists, because this would finance the mercantilist empire, just as the Bank of England had financed the mercantilist empire in England. Okay, and so another thing Hamilton did was he was not only Machiavellian in his discussions of the public debt, but everything he did was aimed at causing the government to be bigger than it actually was. And I think to understand this, you have to understand that Jefferson was famously known as a strict constructionist with regard to the Constitution. That is, strict construction meant stick to the letter of the document. The government has no powers to do anything more than what is right there in black and white. Hamilton was just the opposite. Hamilton thought that the document could and should be interpreted by clever lawyers like himself to give a rubber stamp on anything and everything the government ever wanted to do. So he saw the Constitution as a means of achieving unlimited governmental growth because slick lawyers like himself could reinterpret the document and make things up and give the government all sorts of powers that were not there in the Constitution. So in addition to inventing the notion of implied powers, he was the first to pervert the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, which originally was aimed at giving the federal government the ability to promote free trade between the states by outlawing tariffs at the state level. But successive generations of politicians have used the Commerce Clause to make the argument that, well, if the government has the right to regulate interstate commerce, just about everything affects interstate commerce in one way or another. Education, for example. The argument has been made that the government, the federal government, has the right to regulate what goes on in state and local public schools because of the Commerce Clause, because after all, education affects worker productivity. Worker productivity affects the production of goods and services. All goods and services cross state lines. Therefore, the government has the constitutional right and duty to enforce, to regulate all of primary and secondary education in the public school system. That argument was actually made about 15 years ago in a Supreme Court case. And so that's the type of perversion of the Commerce Clause that has occurred. But it was Alexander Hamilton who was the very first who showed them the way how to do that. He also showed the way in how to pervert the General Welfare Clause of the Constitution, which was originally meant to say that the federal government only has the constitutional right to do things that would promote the general welfare of just about everyone. But of course, that's been redefined so many times that just about anything, any special interest program the government puts into place is called general welfare now. And here's what a man named Douglas Adair, spelled A-D-A-I-R, who was a one-time editor of the Federalist Papers, said about Hamilton as a political conniver. Let me see what's being said here for one second. Okay, I don't see any problems with the volume. Here's what Douglas Adair said about Hamilton as Treasury Secretary. With devious brilliance, Hamilton set out by a program of class legislation to unite the property interests of the Eastern Seaboard into a cohesive administration party, while at the same time he attempted to make the executive dominant over the Congress by a lavish use of the spoils system, i.e. government jobs, to political supporters. In carrying out his scheme, Hamilton transformed every financial transaction of the Treasury Department into an orgy of speculation and graft, in which selected senators, congressmen, and certain of their richer constituents throughout the nation participated. So he did that. And also, he nationalized the old state government debt as Treasury Secretary. And this created a giant arbitrage scheme that made millionaires, literally millionaires, out of many members of Congress. So Hamilton, to achieve his ends, keep in mind what that quote of Rothbard in the beginning, of what these people were up to, what the nationalists were up to. They wanted a central bank that would finance corporate welfare with protectionist tariffs and a heavy public debt as the American economic American system. Hamilton called this the American system, by the way. And even though it was really the British system, the American version of the British system, he coined the phrase the American system, which lasted up to the days of Abraham Lincoln and was still being called the American system in the 1850s and 1860s. But the next thing he did, though, as Treasury Secretary, nationalizing the state debts. And so what happened here was, this, of course, was long before the Internet and long before television. And so the insiders in Congress and their friends knew that the government was going to pay off the old war debts at par value. Whereas at the time, a lot of these debts, these bonds, government bonds, had been issued to Revolutionary War veterans as a means of paying them for their service, and they were trading between 2% and 10% of par value. So the insiders, the political insiders, knew that if you had this bond that today was trading at, say, 2% of par value, that the government, in 6 weeks, the government was going to pay you 100% of par value. So you could make a killing if you started collecting these bonds. And there's a biographer of Jefferson and Hamilton named Claude Bowers, who wrote a book called Jefferson and Hamilton. And he explained this way, here's how he explained of what happened once this law was passed to nationalize the old war debt. Expresses with very large sums of money were on their way to North Carolina for purposes of speculation and certificates. And they splashed and bumped over wretched winter roads, two fast-sailing vessels chartered by a member of Congress who had been an officer in the war, were plowing the waters southward on a similar mission. So there was a mad rush by the political insiders, including members of Congress, including Hamilton himself, to buy up as many of these war bonds as they could, because they knew they were going to turn them in and sell them at par value. And they did make a killing. According to Bowers, Robert Morris made at least $18 million in the deal. Governor George Clinton of New York made $5 million. Hamilton himself purchased some of the bonds. And so what Hamilton was doing here was using this arbitrage scheme to buy the votes of members of Congress by making them rich through this political insider game. And by buying their votes for what? Votes for protectionist tariffs, votes for a national bank, votes for corporate welfare for road and canal building corporations, and votes in favor of a large public debt, the Federalist agenda, Federalist economic agenda. So all of these shenanigans were all about getting the so-called American system put into place. And Thomas Jefferson smoked out Hamilton. He knew exactly what was going on. And in his writings, long after Hamilton's death, actually, Hamilton, of course, died in 1804 from a duel with Aaron Burr. And here's what Jefferson said. He said, of these men, these members of Congress who had been enriched by Hamilton's scheme, he said, men thus enriched by the dexterity of a leader would follow, of course, the chief who was leading them to fortune, and thus become a zealous instrument of all his political enterprises, who is buying off their votes. The problem, though, for Hamilton was that this was a one-time exercise. And so these men would all eventually retire or die. And so the Federalist Party needed something more permanent. Here's what Jefferson said. He said, the political power created by these schemes would be temporary, and it would be lost with the loss of the individual members whom it had enriched. Some engine of influence more permanent must be contrived, said Jefferson. Okay, and he said, and, quote, this engine of corruption was the Bank of the United States. It is a national bank. And so this is what led Jefferson to say that Hamilton was a, quote, not only a monarchist, but for monarchy bottomed on corruption. And in a letter, in a letter that Jefferson wrote years after Hamilton's death, he talks about a dinner that was attended by himself, Alexander Hamilton, President John Adams, and several others of that generation, in which John Adams said, if it weren't for the corruption, the British Constitution would be a perfect document. And Jefferson says, on the graves of my children, I swear this is true, that what Hamilton did was to respond by saying, oh no, the corruption is the good thing about the British Constitution. It's the corruption that makes the British Constitution the best constitution in the world, not the lack of corruption. And so he perfectly understood that corruption in the form of buying votes needed some sort of engine, and the engine would be a central bank. That's what the engine would be. And so this is, I'm hoping to give you some idea here of who Hamilton was, and it was not just Hamilton, but he was the leader, the intellectual leader and the political leader of the economic nationalists of his day, and he was quite Machiavellian about it. He also wrote a famous report on manufacturers, and you can look it up on the web. I didn't put it on the syllabus. These are big, long-winded documents. In fact, Thomas Jefferson said, after reading Hamilton's reports on the bank and report on manufacturers, Jefferson thought that one of the purposes of these reports was to confuse the public and to dumbfound the public and make it seem as though what he was talking about was so sophisticated and so complicated that you couldn't possibly understand it. So why try? That was Jefferson's opinion, in addition to promoting corruption. And so in his report on manufacturers, Hamilton laid out the economic nationalist agenda that would be pursued for the next several generations, and finally it would succeed, and I think class four is called Hamiltonian hegemony. We'll be talking about that in a couple of weeks. But what did he advocate in the report on manufacturers? Well, corporate bailouts, for one thing, and this would be the bailout of corporations that fail to make a profit. It really strikes a death blow to free market capitalism, because free market capitalism is a profit and loss system. It's not a profit system, profit and loss system. But the system that Hamilton was advocating was private profits but socialized losses when he advocated bailouts. And so, and that would not be capitalism, that's mercantilism. Hamilton was also a severe critic of Adam Smith. Adam Smith, probably his most famous idea, has come to be known as the invisible hand, which is really a key element of Austrian economics. It's what Friedrich Hayek devoted much of his career to, his writing about the spontaneous order of markets, about how markets rely on widely decentralized knowledge in the minds of the billions of consumers and workers and entrepreneurs and investors and market participants of all sorts. And we all use all of this knowledge to produce goods and services under the International Division of Labor. And when we profit from these efforts, we use our money, we use our profits or our wages to purchase goods and services from people who specialize in other things. That's what the free market is. But Hamilton rejected this. He thought that the market had to be guided by the hand of government, especially by himself. And so he was in favor of the government picking winners and losers, picking industries that it thought, the government thought, would be the winning industries of the future, and therefore subsidizing them with tax dollars. And this also is an assault on free market capitalism, because it's a very different system than a system where investors and entrepreneurs are putting up their own money, they're taking a risk. And what are they risking? They're risking that the product or service that they want to finance and supply to their fellow human beings will be to the liking of their fellow human beings, so that their fellow human beings will hand over money in return for the product or service. One of my favorite sayings or slogans from The Wealth of Nations is when Adam Smith says, his definition of capitalism is, give me that which I want and I will give you that which you want. That's capitalism. But under central planning, it's the government will tell you what you're going to get, and we will tax you and force you to pay for it whether you really want it or not. So consumer sovereignty is thrown out the door whenever the government gets involved in deciding what is to produce, how much is to produce, and so forth. But that's the essence of what Hamilton was arguing for in his famous report on manufacturers. And this idea lives today, it lives on today. In the 1980s, it was called industrial policy. And there was a big debate in the U.S. over so-called industrial policy, which was just warmed over Hamiltonian mercantilism. And, of course, now it's called green technology. It's called subsidies for green technology. But it's basically the same bad idea. And, of course, whenever the government does get involved in these things, what determines who gets the money is political clout and the ability of the companies who receive the money to provide financial support and voting support for the people in government who dispense the tax dollars. It really has little or nothing to do with economic viability or consumer sovereignty. Hamilton also condemned the fear of failure. He said we need the government to subsidize private businesses because the businesses often fear failure, therefore they don't do it. They don't even go into business. But again, this is sort of a silly way of looking at things, because fear of failure is a good thing. If I wanted to go into the business, say, going to county fairs in the United States, selling porcupine on a stick as a snack or a treat, I doubt that I would get anybody to buy porcupine on a stick. And so it's a good thing that I fear failure of a stupid business like that. And so Hamilton used this argument to make his case for government subsidies. He famously made the case for protectionism for infant industries, the so-called new industries that can't compete, say, with British industries that have been around for decades. They need governmental help. And of course, economists have long recognized that infant industries never grow up. The American steel industry was protected with tariffs and quotas in the 19th century, in the mid-19th century, almost from the very beginning of the American steel industry. And then you fast forward to the Bush administration in 2001, the first thing, the very first thing President George W. Bush did was to impose 35% tariffs on steel. So they were still being protected or treated like infants 150 years later. So infant industries never grow up. And if you think about it, there's the question of, well, if the British at the time had mature industries, how did they grow up? How did they grow up without government support? How does Microsoft exist? How did IBM exist in the United States? There were other companies. IBM existed before Microsoft did, and Microsoft was created by Bill Gates and some of his friends in the late 70s. They didn't need government money to compete with one of the largest corporations, if not the largest corporation in the world, Microsoft. And so, but that's the argument that was being made, and you still hear this argument today. Hamilton was largely ignorant of economics. And as I mentioned earlier, he collected some of what in our day would be called cliff notes to study up on the language of finance to write his famous letter to Robert Morris. That's pretty much all he knew about economics. I mean, He badmouthed and denigrated Adam Smith, who I don't really think he ever read, but he knew about the ideas of Adam Smith, and enough to dismiss them because they did not make the case for central planning of any sort by government officials like himself. And so he made his case for protectionism based on all sorts of superstitions that had been invented by publicists for British mercantilists. One of Hamilton's sources was a book or books by Sir James Stewart, who was a British propagandist for the British mercantilist system. And one of the arguments he made was that protectionism will cause prices to go down. If you keep out international competition, he said, prices will go down because it will cause domestic producers to compete more fiercely if they do not have international competition. Even during his time, anyone who had ever studied the issue knew that this was exactly backwards, that if more competition leads to lower prices, it's not less competition that leads to lower prices. He also said transportation cost is a waste of money. Therefore, if we can produce anything here, we should not allow it to be imported into the United States because in addition to the cost of the item, there is a transportation cost, and we will be increasing the cost to ourselves. So therefore, anything that we can make or grow here, we should have prohibitions on importation. And Abraham Lincoln made this exact same argument in the late 1850s. And he, of course, was a Hamiltonian nationalist on economic issues. And so this, of course, is another dumb idea because, we have, even during Hamilton's time, we had generations of examples of companies facing transportation costs and finding ways to cut their cost of production so that they can compete on price in foreign countries. That's what competition is about. And so... And also, the government itself facilitated and encouraged transportation or competition between the states, interstate competition between businesses by banning tariffs at the state level. And so, Hamilton was a New Yorker. He would not have called for the banning of imports of things into New York State, just only into the country. And he at one point in the report on manufacturers makes the case for the prohibition of imports altogether. It's an extreme autarky, which is spelled A-U-T-A-R-K-Y. And so if we were to do that, we would have divorced ourselves from the International Division of Labor, which is the sole source of human civilization. Adam Smith explained this very well in his book, and that's why ideas like this are extraordinarily dangerous. In many, many ways. Not only would they increase for us the cost of producing things and the cost to consumers, but autarky or economic independence or attempts at economic independence were a major source of war all throughout European history. Nazi Germany adopted the policy of autarky or an attempt to be economically self-sufficient. And of course, they found that there were a lot of natural resources that they did not have in Germany. Therefore, they needed to try to steal them from the Poles, from the French, and from the Belgians, and from anyone else who they could steal them from through military invasion. So this idea of economic autarky or economic self-sufficiency is not only economically foolish, but it has been very dangerous throughout history in that it has led to war. And there's nothing more costly than war. Hamilton, in his report on manufacturers, advocates government bonuses for excellence of manufacturing, which again shows a complete misunderstanding of economics in the very simplest sense. Because the way in which businesses are rewarded for excellence is that consumers will buy their products and they will make profits. They don't need government bureaucrats to pick and choose what products are excellent and what are not. In fact, if you ever did adopt a system like that, politics would determine who gets the award of excellence and the money, not economics. It's not the consumers. It's the political connections that will determine who gets the governmental pelt, not consumer sovereignty. But Hamilton advocated that also. And, of course, he advocated internal improvement subsidies or massive subsidies for the building of roads and canals. And next week we're going to talk about that in much more detail, so I'm not going to say much about that. And many state governments did eventually adopt this Hamiltonian idea of using state tax revenues to try to build roads and canals And all I'll say for now was that it was a colossal financial catastrophe in every state, so much so that by the time you get to the 1860s, every state but Massachusetts had amended its constitution to prohibit the use of tax revenues to be given to any corporation for any reason, road building, canal building, or anything else, because it had been such a catastrophe for many decades by that point. But this was Hamilton's idea, and this sort of idea lives on today. State government socialized roads. It's the same idea. And one other thing I'd like to mention here is, this American system that was adopted by the nationalists or the federalists at the time of Hamilton, central bank, corporate welfare, protectionist tariffs, large national debt, that formed the nucleus of the economic policy debate of the 19th century up through the American Civil War era and beyond the Civil War era. So I'm going to talk about that next week. So this was a very big, big part of a big, long stretch of American history. And in a couple of the articles that I put on the syllabus, you can read about how commentators today are Hamiltonians or neo-Hamiltonians who praise Hamilton's The Tree Top. When my book, Hamilton's Curse, came out, I was invited to be on MSNBC and the Morning Joe program. And so I went down there, and they sat me down next to Patrick J. Buchanan, and the first thing he says to me is, Alexander Hamilton is my hero. And so the five of them pretty much shouted me down, didn't let me say anything, as usual. And so you have a lot of right-wingers like Buchanan or Hamiltonians, William Crystal and the neocons, almost all of them claim to be Hamiltonians, and you have the liberals at the Brookings Institution in the United States who are also Hamiltonians. They have something at Brookings called the Hamilton Project, which is a big long list of government interventions in the economy that they would like to achieve. And so this ideology lives on today. I'm not just talking about ancient history here for the sake of learning about history. This has always been one of the ingredients of American economic intervention, one of the ideological cornerstones of economic interventionism in America. And I'd like to give one example of this. And there's an article that I published on Mises.org several years ago called A Fake Banking History of the United States. And it was a criticism of an article by John Steele Gordon in the October 10th, 2008 Wall Street Journal, entitled A Short Banking History of the United States. And in this article, John Steele Gordon, who's a pretty good economic historian, I like some of his books that I've read, and he blamed the current economic debacle, the Great Recession, as it is called, on, get this, quote, the baleful influence of Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson had been dead for a couple hundred years. John Steele Gordon, writing in the Wall Street Journal in the year 2008, blames the Great Recession on Thomas Jefferson. What's that about? Well, he goes on to say that, well, it was Jefferson who opposed the Bank of the United States, the first central bank that we got. And so so these arguments against a bank run by politicians out of the nation's capital, these arguments against that idea are alive and well today. Look at the Ron Paul presidential candidacy, John Steele Gordon said. And so he blamed people like Ron Paul and Fed critics for the Great Recession, saying that the cause of the problem is the Fed is not powerful enough. I don't want to really get into that now, other than to say it's ludicrous. But Gordon went on a rampage there, claiming that Thomas Jefferson hated commerce. These are his words. He hated banks and had a profound understanding. And by contrast, Hamilton had, quote, a profound understanding of markets. How did Hamilton gain this profound understanding of markets? Well, if you read the biographies of Hamilton, they claim that he became a whiz in markets, not by studying economics, not by reading Adam Smith or any of the other writers of his day who really were studying economics, but as a teenager, he worked for a group of slave-owning molasses traders in the island of St. Croix in the Caribbean. And these men liked Hamilton a lot. He was a bright young man. They sent him to school in the United States at what is now Columbia University. They liked him so much. He was such a good worker. And so that's where he supposedly learned his economics, which is really not no economics at all. Out of the volume, I just had some kind of weird message on my list here. Okay. But here's what, in contrast to what John Stowe Gordon said, so this is very typical of historians, not economists, but historians saying that Hamilton was some sort of economic genius. Patrick Buchanan had said this. Jefferson, he was a farmer. He hated banks, hated commerce. Even though he was a businessman, he hated commerce. But here's what Murray Rothbard wrote. He wrote an article of his that's on the web entitled A Future of Peace and Capitalism. He says this, Jefferson was very precisely in favor of laissez-faire or free market capitalism. And that was the real argument between Hamilton and Jefferson. It wasn't really that Jefferson was against factories or industries per se. What he was against was coerced development, that is, taxing the farmers through tariffs and subsidies to build up industry artificially, which was essentially the Hamilton program. Jefferson was a very learned person. He had read Adam Smith. He read Ricardo. He was very familiar with laissez-faire classical economics. And so his economic program was a very sophisticated application of classical economics to the American scene. Classicists were also against tariffs, against government subsidies, and coerced economic development. The Jeffersonian wing of the Founding Fathers was essentially free market laissez-faire capitalists. So compared to Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton was an economic ignoramus. And it's not just me saying this, it's not just Murray Rothbard saying this. There's a biography of Hamilton by William Graham Sumner, the great late 19th century libertarian sociologist from Yale University, where he talks about Hamilton's economic ideas. He calls it mysticism. He says he's in a fog over mysticism around surrounding mercantilism and all of these superstitions that have been created in support of mercantilism over all these years. And so that's the way I think we ought to look at it. And I guess I've been going on for almost an hour now, and so I think I'll stop there with the lecture. And what I wanted to do is to give an outline of where this debate started. And in the next couple of weeks, we're going to go up through different people, Henry Clay and his associates in the early 19th century in the Lincoln administration, which finally cemented into place the system of economic nationalism, and then we're going to talk about the implications for the world today, not just the United States, but the world in general. And so I think I'll stop there and take a look at the chat. If you have any questions, feel free to put them either in the Q&A or the chat. I'll be checking on the Q&A and the chat, and I'll do my best to answer the questions. And Cam is doing a great job, as always, I see. I mentioned the book by William Graham Sumner, and there it is online right there. It is a very interesting book. William Graham Sumner is sort of a forgotten man, but he was one of the great late 19th, early 20th century libertarians. So feel free to ask questions if you have any. You don't have to, and this is, we're laissez-faire types around here. So I'll just sit here and wait in case somebody has a question. Let's see, Malcolm is asking, is there a book article on the propaganda machine of the mercantilists? There are at least one book, maybe two books, written on mercantilism by Robert Eklund, that's spelled E-K-E-L-U-N-D, and Robert Tolleson. I know they wrote a couple of short books on mercantilism, and Eklund and Paulson are very good public choice economists, very good public choice and political economists. And so if you wanted to look for a book on the propaganda machine behind mercantilism, that would be one good place to look for it. There's a big two-volume set of books, very old books, on mercantilism by Eli Heckscher. And I think the name is spelled H-E-C-K-S-H-E-R, Eli Heckscher. If you fool around on Google, you probably find it. And for example, when I was in graduate school, many years ago when the dinosaurs still roamed the earth, this is one of the books I read in a course I took in the history of economic thought. It was Eli Heckscher on mercantilism. So it's a very old book, a long, long time ago, but mercantilism is a very, very old idea. And so that's another place where I would look for this. And of course, the Austrian economist, von Mises, Human Action, in his book on socialism, has commentary on mercantilist myths, whenever you read about the case for free trade, for example. Let's see, David, I have a question from David Kassler. He's of the opinion that the U.S. began with a strong free market foundation. Well, it's always relative. What we're talking about here was really a struggle between one group of people, the Jeffersonians, who were, by and large, advocates of laissez-faire economics, as Murray Rothbard said, and the interventionists. The Federalists, the Hamiltonians, who wanted to bring British-style mercantilism to America, but they didn't succeed until after the Civil War. And so that's the story I'm going to be telling next week of how we came to adopt this system. But these are the seeds of this argument were some of the ideas I talked about tonight with regard to Hamilton and his influence, his enormous influence that exists to this day in the United States and elsewhere. His ideas. Well, I'll talk about the immigration of these ideas. They came from Europe originally. They were promoted by Hamilton and his followers. Then they went back to Europe in the 19th century, the early 20th century, specifically the German historical school of economics adopted all these Hamiltonian ideas. And then many Americans went to Germany at this time, late 19th, early 20th century, and then came back to America to teach these bad ideas to Americans. So they've been crossing the oceans, over the generations. But it's sort of an interesting travelogue of these bad ideas. And so, but it's all relative. At the time of the outbreak of the American Civil War, the average American paid only about $45 in today's money in federal taxes. So we did have a largely, if you look at the end of the Civil War when slavery was ended, you had the ending of slavery, you had the beginning of totally free labor, and still taxes were still relatively low, even though the country had been through a massive war, it was still relatively low as far as that's concerned. So it's all relative in terms of how much government interventionism there was in the first 100 years. Let's see, Joel's asking about Hamilton's role in the constitutional convention and changing that event from a few tweets of the Articles of Confederation to a major overhaul. Well, no one lobbied more for a constitutional convention than Hamilton. He spent 7 years politicking for it, and when he arrived at the convention, he laid out his plan, which was Robert Morris's plan, the plan of the Federalists, the plan of the Nationalists, and it was a plan for a permanent president, a king, who would appoint all the governors of all the states, and the governors would have veto power over all state legislation by the legislatures. And so you essentially would have had a monarchy. Under the Hamilton system. And so, of course, they did not adopt that system. They did not adopt the central bank. They did not adopt the king. And so Hamilton left in a huff after only a few days, and it was obvious that his plan was being thrown out and was not acceptable. But he never gave up. And so he was one of the authors of the Federalist Papers, which was primarily an attempt to get the Constitution through New York, to get New York to ratify the Federalist Papers, co-authored with James Madison and John Jay. And so the Constitution did create a more centralized government because the states had taxing power under the first Constitution, the Articles of Confederation, but federal government was getting taxing powers, no income taxing powers, but tariff taxing powers under the new Constitution. And for example, by the time you get to the American Civil War, the early 1860s, 90 to 95% of all federal tax revenue came from tariffs on imports. So that was how the federal government was funded during that era. And so Hamilton, as soon as the Constitution was adopted, he condemned it as, in his words, a frail and useless and worthless fabric. And he did whatever he could for the rest of his life to undermine or subvert the Constitution. As I mentioned earlier, it was Hamilton, in his report on the bank, who invented the idea of implied powers of the Constitution in order to destroy the limits of the Constitution. It was Hamilton who first invented the creative reinterpretation of the commerce and general welfare clauses to create a system of constitutional government that would be virtually unlimited. And so he didn't get his way at the convention, but he, with the help of a lot of people like John Marshall, the Chief Justice of the United States for 33 years, beginning in 1801, he was a disciple of Alexander Hamilton, and he made many creative reinterpretations of the document. Hamilton also invented the big lie that the states were never sovereign, that the states did not ratify the Constitution, that somehow the federal government created the states. And that, of course, never happened that way. All you have to do is read Article 7 of the U.S. Constitution, which explains that the Constitution would be ratified by the states, by political conventions at the state level. And so in order to make the case for a monopolistic, centralized government, the nationalists began rewriting history and claiming that the states did not ratify the Constitution. They were betting on the fact that the Americans a generation hence would be so rationally ignorant of their own history that they could get away with this big lie. And they eventually did during the Lincoln years. Lincoln used the same argument to argue that the states were never sovereign and therefore could not secede from the Union. And so, but that was, Hamilton was the originator of this big lie, a big historical lie. And so that, in a nutshell, that's what Hamilton had to do with constitutional subversion. And I did put on the syllabus for this week one of my short articles entitled The Founding Father of Constitutional Subversion that explains that. Let's see. Christopher wants to know who, if anyone, influenced Hamilton's notion that it's proper for a government to run a central bank. Well, Robert Morris is the one who wanted a central bank. He got the government to start up the first central bank, which was the Bank of North America. But it was such a failure that after only 1 year, its currency was totally devalued and it was privatized. And so it was Robert Morris who, it wasn't just Robert Morris, it was with the New York, Philadelphia, Boston business and banking interests who the Federalist Party spoke for. And Robert Morris was just one of the wealthiest of all of them. And he was Hamilton's protector within the government and promoter. And so Hamilton got these ideas from Robert Morris. It's what they wanted. Because they figured that their party, the Federalist Party, could be in power forever if they could have a bank to finance their political conniving. They could use tax funds to skew politics, to influence elections, to give special benefits and cheap credit to their political supporters. Well, it would be an unlimited source of political patronage. And they, the Federalists, would be in power forever, and therefore they could get what they wanted. They could get not only their central bank, they could get massive corporate welfare, they could get protectionist tariffs, they could get a big public debt, all the things that they wanted. Bailouts, that was the plan. Okay, here's Eli Hetcher. I even spelled it correctly when I mentioned his name. That's a miracle. Here's a question from Malcolm Arnold about the whiskey taxes. Well, some of the states did a good job. When Hamilton nationalized the state debts, some states like Virginia had almost paid off their share of the debt. Other states like Massachusetts had hardly paid anything. And so states like Massachusetts were free riding on the responsible states like Virginia that had been paying their way. And so to bail out the New England Yankees, they imposed several taxes, such as the whiskey tax. And this led to the Whiskey Rebellion in Pennsylvania. And particularly, it was centered in south of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where there were grain farmers who decided they could make more money by getting their grain and fermenting it and turning it into whiskey than by selling it as grain. And they protested that they thought it was an unfair tax because there was no similar tax on tobacco or cotton or rice or other things. You know, why us? Why the whiskey tax? And so Hamilton himself persuaded George Washington to go and ride the 13,000 conscripts that the governors of the eastern seaboard states had drafted to go and put down the Whiskey Rebellion. And the officers in this small army were, according to Claude Bowers, the historian I mentioned earlier, were all big bondholders, government bondholders. And so they were the officers with this army of conscripts, 13,000 strong, to go and make sure that they could collect that whiskey tax so that their bonds, their government bonds, could be paid off, so that the principal and interest would be paid off. And so they rode into Pennsylvania, and they rounded up a couple of dozen of the leaders of the Whiskey Rebellion and made them walk from western Pennsylvania, south Pittsburgh, all the way to Philadelphia in the winter, and then put them on trial with Hamilton himself as the judge. And Hamilton wanted to hang all of them, but George Washington, who had left at this point, had gone home, pardoned all of the tax protesters. So in the end, the tax protesters won out, and then the protesters were not hanged to their death, as Hamilton wanted to do. And also, Thomas Jefferson then became president, and he got Congress to eliminate the whiskey tax and most other taxes at the same time. And that was the end of the Whiskey Rebellion. It played a key role in destroying the Federalist Party, in other words, with its heavy-handed taxation and the use of an army. And that reading about that convinced me that the reason why Hamilton was also a big advocate of the standing army was that he understood that in British history, the standing army was primarily used to intimidate the population, to intimidate the citizens, and to collect taxes from them, not to defend them so much from foreign invaders. And so that's what he wanted a standing army for, in my opinion, to do what they did during the Whiskey Rebellion. Christopher asks, how did early central planners reconcile individual sovereignty with state economic and banking controls? They didn't care about that. Hamilton certainly didn't care about individual sovereignty. But like I said, there was a libertarian wing. One particularly powerful writer was John Taylor. He was known as John Taylor of Carolina. And he wrote an excellent book called Tyranny Unmasked, which may be online now. It was written, I think, in 1823. And John Taylor's language is very verbose, a little excessively verbose, but he understood all of the economics of his time. He understood Adam Smith and David Ricardo and the French physiocrats, which were sort of precursors to the Austrian school of economics. And he also would be considered to be a public choice economist. He understood the integration of politics and economics very, very well. So there were people like this at the time who were powerful opponents, powerful intellectual opponents of the interventionists who wanted to adopt some sort of central planning, the Hamiltonian. And so if you want to read about that, one place to start would be some of John Taylor's books. He was known as John Taylor of Caroline because he was from Caroline County, Virginia. See, oh, there's the link to Robert Eklund's Mercantilism of the Rent-Seeking Society. Let's see, John Anderson asked, during the 1790s, were there functioning examples of free market capitalism? Well, yes, there were. You know, the Dutch capitalism as we know it probably began in Holland. A good book on this is by Nathan Rosenberg and Birdsell. Last name is B-I-R-D-S-E-L-L. Rosenberg and Birdsell. And it's How the West Grew Rich. If you want to read about this, it's a history of the evolution of capitalism beginning in the 1500s. Or I think it actually begins in the 1400s, the book does, and talks about the evolution of capitalism. And it talks about such things as with the invention of sailing ships with three masts that enabled ships to go between continents across the Atlantic Ocean, for example. And that gave a big spur to capitalism. And so, sure, there were, capitalism is simply give me that which I want and I will give you that which you want. And so trade, their trade had gone on from the earliest times, even before there was money, there was trade. And so that's all capitalism is mutually advantageous trade in a peaceful and voluntary manner between individuals. And so it was all around the world, although governments always try to horn in on it to some degree or another. But that would be the book to read if you really want to understand the evolution of capitalism and where it was being practiced at the time. The British capital markets, for example, were pretty sophisticated by the time you get to the year 1800. They had been around for a long, long time. And the American capital markets were, of course, brand new. They were just being formed. But they had good examples in the private banking systems of Europe. Let's see. Another question that John has is, can Hamilton really be vilified because he wanted to emulate what was perceived to work in Great Britain? Well, it didn't work in Great Britain because Adam Smith had proven in 1776, when his book The Wealth of Nations was published, that mercantilism had been an impoverishing system. And in fact, Great Britain itself, by 1850, had abolished all tariffs altogether. And so it had been proven not only by just Adam Smith, but by Ricardo and the French physiocrats and Turgot. If you go into Thomas Jefferson's home tomorrow in Monticello in Charlottesville, Virginia, there is a bust of Turgot, the French finance minister, who was a good friend of Jefferson. Jefferson translated Turgot's economic writings into English. And you can still see his bust right there by the front door of Monticello. And at the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama, on the walls in some of the rooms, there are the names of Austrians and pre-Austrians, precursors to the Austrian school throughout history. And Turgot was one of the names up on the second floor in the massive library room. And so, so it was well known at the time. It was already well known that the markets work and that governments don't. And so that's why the Jeffersonians were such vociferous opponents, strong opponents. They had studied political history. They had studied the economics of their day. Jefferson himself, as I said in a quote from Rothbard, he translated Turgot, which was a book on the free market economics of his day. And so and Hamilton ignored all this and was essentially a shill for the neo-mercantilists in America. Now, Hamilton did not accomplish hardly anything. He did accomplish getting a this question from James Blackstone. Hamilton did get the Bank of the United States put into place during his time. He did not get federal subsidies for internal improvements. He did not get protectionist tariffs. He did not get a large national debt. That would come later. The Hamiltonians, his followers, would achieve this eventually, but not in his time. This book on the Whiskey Rebellion is a question from Malcolm Arnold. Go to Mises.org and type in Whiskey Rebellion. There's an author that's written an article about his book. I'm looking it up right now so I give you the exact citation. I think I found the exact citation here. Yeah, the author is William Hoagland, H-O-G-E-L-A-N-D, and his book is The Whiskey Rebellion. It's a pretty good book. Hoagland is a liberal, an American liberal, and he wrote a very good book that's sort of very libertarian sounding, very truthful book. I think it's Murray Rothbard. Murray Rothbard also wrote an article or two about the Whiskey Rebellion. I think it was in the Free Market many, many years ago. So if you go on Mises.org and type in Murray Rothbard and the Whiskey Rebellion, you'll probably find his old article on it from the Free Market publication. And he agreed with Hoagland. And Hoagland, historians have written incorrect history by concluding that the Whiskey Rebellion was a failure, and when Washington and Hamilton wrote up Pennsylvania, they demonstrated the taxing power of the state. Hooray. But of course, what actually happened was the rebellion worked. The Federalist Party got kicked out of office and the whiskey tax was abolished. And Hoagland writes this story. He writes it much more truthful. I've read several books on it. I think William Hoagland's book is the best that I've read so far. Yeah, I guess we've got to stop any time now. There's another class coming on in Mises Academy. Let's see, one more question, a book about the railroads. Yeah, can you hear the whistle blowing? Dee Brown, D-E-E, first name, Brown. Can you hear hear that lonesome whistle blow? The history of the building of the Transcontinental Railroads. And I'll talk about that next week, actually. But our time is about up. I guess there's another class at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, I suspect. Maybe not this week, but in a week or two. So we should probably make it a point to call it a night. So thanks for participating, and I hope you learned something. And I'll do my best to have you learn a little more next week.